You're listening to the Voice of Russia in London. I'm Alice Lanyado. Welcome to Curtain Up, the program about Russian culture in the capital.
Тебя ж никто не учит, что трава зеленая, снег белый, что поезд колесами стучит. Это как-то все вокруг присутствует.
We start our program this week with film director Mikhail Segal, who's just been to London for the premiere of his film Short Stories.
А ты хоть понимаешь, где ты живешь?
В Российской Федерации.
It's been shown at both the BFI London Film Festival and the Academia Russica Film Festival. Short Stories is a witty and stylish film which tells the tales of different people living in Russia today, from a young couple about to get married to a university lecturer forced to take bribes to pay for an operation for his sick mother. I invited Mikhail into the studio and started by asking him how his film has been received here.
I was concerned very much about the possibility of international understanding of my film because I thought that this film is too Russian. I was very surprised that people in London understood it and liked it. But, I don't know, in Russian you can say it's not a pure experiment because maybe 50 or 60% of audience was a Russian audience who live in London.
Well, when I went, certainly the cinema was packed and there were a lot of British people there and a lot of British people asking you questions. I thought for people who didn't know anything about Russia, it was a great film to go to because it gave you lots of pictures, different pictures of Russia today without moralizing or giving a very didactic message to people. I wanted to ask you how far you see your film as a realistic portrayal of modern Russia. For example, The Wedding Planner is a very unusual wedding planner. I don't know anything about wedding planners in today's Russia. I don't know whether young people spend a lot of time and money on creating an ideal wedding. I wanted to ask you how realistic that was.
Of course, my story are not realistic. Mainly, it's absurd. It's created world. But what's reality? Reality is my perception of contemporary Russian situation. To express this reality, I'm sharing what modern Russia is like through my fantasy.
Obviously, it's not totally realistic. I mean, it's incredibly funny and quite sad in some ways as well when the wedding planner wants to organise everything in advance for this young couple, including the affairs that he predicts that they will have after just a few years of married life. Is that because young people in Russia do plan their weddings today very carefully? What is that about?
Of course, it's not a reality. It's absurd and grotesque. And I took just a funny piece of something I found very typical in contemporary Russian young characters, and I multiplied it 100 times, and I've got my story. So, of course, it's a comedy, it's grotesque comedy.
And there was a contrast, wasn't there, with the couple, the beautiful couple, the handsome wedding planner, the lovely room they were in with the books, and then you looked outside the window to a landscape that was quite bleak. People spend a lot of money on weddings in Britain as well, but I wondered whether there was something specific, something particularly Russian about the approach to weddings now. I mean, you're quite young yourself, so you must see this all around you.
In reality, I've been at wedding maybe 2 times in my life, and when I was a very small boy, it was just
a fantasy.
A fantasy and just a way to express what I think about contemporary Russian young people in general. I wanted to say that this part of contemporary Russian young people, new generation, this is a story about young people who cannot live in the moment, who need to organize everything in advance to predict their future. They're not comfortable if they don't know what will happen tomorrow.
Могу предложить 2050-2055.
And they really think that if they organize everything in advance, their life will be very happy.
And that's quite a contrast, isn't it? Because the previous generations couldn't plan their lives in such detail in Russia.
The previous generation, and if we say the previous generation, we say about, for example, my parents, my grandparents who lived during the Soviet period, Soviet time. They couldn't plan their future because
it didn't depend on them.
Yes. Они не могли ничего планировать, потому что каждый день был похож на предыдущий. Они знали, что вот есть советская жизнь, и бессмысленно проявлять инициативу и что-то делать, потому что социальная ситуация все равно не даст им возможности это реализовать.
So you're saying that your parents and grandparents couldn't overplan because their lives were quite limited. And there was no point in them trying to plan too much. They couldn't do certain things, so that there was no point in even trying.
Yes.
One of the short stories in your film that I didn't like at first at all, and then I came to appreciate as it went on, was about a middle-aged man who falls for a very beautiful, very young woman. His life is transformed, but then he starts to talk to her about history, doesn't he? And he realizes that she has barely any understanding of the history of her own country. He seems to feel a very sharp kind of disappointment and perhaps even disgust. What inspired you to write this particular story?
Like every story, the first point was a real situation in my life. I was talking with a real girl. For the first view, there are themes for talking, common themes, and I couldn't see the difference and the very big. For the first time, I'm in London now, I know the word gap. I couldn't see the gap between us. Piece by piece, I began to understand that we're absolutely different people.
Was she a lot younger than you, Mikhail?
Of course.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 38.
And she was?
22. But they're really from a new generation, because my generation isn't very different from previous generation. For example, I was born in 70s, and my generation is not very different from people who were born in 60s or even in the end of 50s, because the reality and cultural reality and aesthetic reality during also that time was almost the same. But when the Soviet Union ended, Realities changed in our daily life. For the first year, we couldn't see it. But as I said before, piece by piece, now we can feel the difference between us.
Does it shock you that young people like that don't know the basics of the history of their own country? Does it upset you?
No, it's not shocked me, because I found it quite funny, because I understand that time is going and it's not their fault that they were born in another time.
But maybe their parents should have told them about what happened under Stalin.
No, I think it's impossible. I think the new time is stronger than our parents.
And finally, Mikhail Sigal, I'd like to ask you, do you have an optimistic view of your country's future?
It's a very simple question. Of course, no. It's not because I'm pessimist. It's just because what I can see now in Russia.
Mikhail Sigal, director of the film Short Stories.
Послушайте, что он пишет об удовольствии.
Счастье простых вещей.
То, что у них гражданское общество, а у нас.
Now we turn to theatre. Michael Boyd, the outgoing artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, is staging a new production of Pushkin's Boris Godunov. The play tells the story of Boris Godunov, a complex and tragic man who ruled Russia in the 16th century. Michael Boyd's long relationship with Russia started when he went to work at the Malaya Bronnaya Theatre in Moscow in 1978. Julian Gallant started by asking Michael Boyd how that first visit came about.
My Russian teacher at my school in Edinburgh came back with many rich tales of exciting things happening, of a mini-thaw, really. Particularly, he was very excited by what was happening at Tabakov Savremennik Theatre. And so I applied for a British Council fellowship, sat in a waiting room with ballerinas, violinists, and nobody whatsoever from a verbal discipline, with a specially convened panel, and was awarded a fellowship to go to Moscow. I said I wanted to go to the Savremennik. Nothing really happened in terms of visas and Ministry of Culture approval for a very long time. Then Anatoly Efros visited the Edinburgh International Festival with Month in the Country and Zhenitsba, and I interviewed him for the Festival Times, the precursor of the List magazine. And he was asking me about what my plans were, and I said I was intending to go to the Savremennik, and he just said, "You don't want to go there. Иди к нам." And then things just sort of worked.
So you had the reference there, you had the introduction yes. there, and you had the contact.
And then I got over there, and it was, yes, it was astonishing.
Did you have the Russian language before you went, or...?
Kind of, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. I did. I'd mm-hmm. done it at school, and I'd done it as a subsidiary mm-hmm. subject at university, but I needed to brush it up before I went. But by the time I came back, I really was... dreaming in Russian, but that was 1979, and it's a long time ago.
It's also yesterday. Well, one of the things that obviously must have struck you there was how strange it is when productions happen and everyone gets involved, and it's not an organized chaos, it's a disorganized chaos, but a wonderful production comes out of it when everyone's involved with it, aren't they? That is the Russian style of theatrical production.
Yes, there's certainly at the Malaya Brone at that time, there was a genuine sense of community, a real commitment to the tutelage of Anatoly Efros. And there was time for things to grow organically. I think my first read-through lasted for 6 weeks there, which was astonishing from the semi-commercial, very pragmatic British theatrical tradition. To be allowed to investigate both new plays and classics in that depth was something that made a deep impression on me, and indeed did shape the way I approached running the Royal Shakespeare Company when mm-hmm. I got that opportunity.
Did it actually clash? Obviously, it influenced you. Did it clash with anything you had before, or did it clash with anything that you subsequently came across in the theatre? Did you have to reconcile your Russian experience with your British experience?
Yes, of course I did. It was a completely different. It was still very much a world based on long-standing ensembles, and I saw huge benefits to that in the secret shorthand shared amongst the company. The level of understanding was tremendous. The depth of emotional courage and playfulness and virtuosity that was possible if you stay together as a band of artists over 20 years. It made a deep impression on me. Of course, there were downsides as well. A friend of mine who worked at the Pushkin Theatre at the time was only performing one night in a month and wasn't currently in rehearsals for anything. He had a really... the whole time of it wasn't good. He was still paid his money, and that was great. But it was paid his salary, but
actually cut out of the work.
He didn't. Basically. I mean, not everyone was favoured, I guess. And I suppose there was maybe a danger, like in the sort of Victorian stock companies in this country, danger of typecasting. Occasionally, people got stuck in a rut of playing certain kinds of characters, and if you got stuck in that kind of rut in Britain, it was easier just to go on to the next contract and maybe hold out until someone offered you something different and you could be then seen differently. But on the whole, it was an inspiring and very exciting and very informative experience, and it has shaped my career.
You're listening to The Voice of Russia in London. This is Curtain Up, the programme about Russian culture in the capital. This week, Julian Gallant, the director of Pushkin House, is talking to Michael Boyd of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Now, you say that came to the Royal Shakespeare Company. You brought knowledge of that. You carried it with you through your life. Of course, at the Royal Shakespeare Company, you've just completed. You're at the tail end of a three-year Russian project with an enormous range of Russian theatre, from classics through to modern theatre. I can't even count how many productions there are, but a great range, all done in English. Tell us a little bit more about that. How did you think it? Why did you bring it now rather than when you first started there, for example?
Well, we've been working on it over the last 3 years, probably. We started with two premieres, one a play by the Ukrainian playwright Natalia Varozhbit, who writes in Russian, about...
That's The Grain, isn't it?
The Grain Store, yeah. About the Ukrainian famine in the 1930s, and a play called The Drunks by the Donenkov brothers, who I think live and work in Moscow. And we did a 3-week-long festival of new... writing for the theatre from Russia. We collaborated a lot with the Royal Court, who's done a lot of work in Russia. We did our own workshops in Moscow, encouraging writers in Moscow, emerging writers for the theatre in Moscow, to look at Shakespeare's dramaturgy and just see where it took them, in a very non-prescriptive way. Just have a look at Shakespeare's dramaturgy if you haven't before. Have a look at it from the point of view of a writer, not just looking at its regular part of the Russian repertoire. Of course it is.
Yes, no Russian can escape Shakespeare, can they?
Absolutely not.
It's part of Russian, all Shakespeare's translated into Russian. It's part of your background, isn't it?
Yeah, and in many ways I found Soviet interpreters of Shakespeare understood life under Elizabeth I better than better than we did. And the terms of Lord Chamberlain's censorship, you know, it was like an X-ray vision of Shakespeare's plays in many ways, and it politicized my approach to Shakespeare very much, seeing the subversive productions in the late 70s. And my latest project, I directed Natalia's The Grain Store. We took a big risk and we premiered, this was a world premiere because we commissioned these plays. We premiered them in a 1,000-seat auditorium in Stratford-upon-Avon. It was extraordinary, reckless, bold step to take. But it worked really well. They sold really well and they were both very successful productions. And now, at the other end of the project, I'm working on Pushkin's Boris Godunov.
Just before we get to Boris Godunov, there's a big issue of translation, isn't there? The Grain Store, for example, was written in Russian, was conceived in Russian, with Russian language, with Russian rhythms of speech. It was translated. Did Sasha Dugdale translate it?
Yes, it was translated by Sasha.
So that's a big issue. Does it translate well? Is it easy to translate, or do you feel that the Russian is coming through, permeating the English language?
Sasha worked very closely with Natasha on it, and also with me, because it was written in Russian and not Ukrainian, so I was able to collaborate in the process from the rehearsal room. And it's always jumping across a river and looking back. It's always a paraphrase, it's always a metaphor, it's always a different way of trying to reinvent the same wheel. But I felt Sasha, who herself is a poet in English, and very playful with language, very sympathetic to Natasha's lyricism and boldness and vulgarity. I thought she did a beautiful job. On Boris Godunov, it's different. I'm working on a translation by Adrian Mitchell, who doesn't have Russian.
Has he published it separately, or was this a special translation?
No,
for you?
It was a commission.
It's a commission for you.
For us. It was the last piece of work that he did before he died. So it's very much dedicated to Adrian, this production, in many ways. And Adrian, the joys of the translation for me have been that Adrian is not only a significant poet in his own right, very experienced in the theatre, the author, the translator and author of the version of Marat Sad that the RSC very successfully did with Peter Brook, for instance, of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, very successful musical that we did. And he's also a great lover of Pushkin. It's a love affair that goes back a long way. I think he was halfway through making a documentary film about Pushkin with, I think, Tony Palmer. I don't know the ins and outs of why it never hit the screen.
So he's a Russophile. He loves Russia and he loves Russian history, but he doesn't have the language himself.
Yeah.
So he's approaching it. He's taking it.
He worked from a literal translation. He was very excited by the emergence of the uncensored version of Boris Godunov in the mid-2000s, I think it became published. And he was working from that, and with a very good literal translation. And I have had, again, the luxury of being able to go through it line by line and respond in rehearsal. And 9 times out of 10, if an actor by week 4 is still really, really struggling with an episode in a scene, it is worth going back
Sure.
To Pushkin.
Sure.
In the original, and you might sometimes find the clue.
It's an extraordinary play, isn't it? Pushkin didn't write very much for the theatre. The Little Tragedies and Boris Godunov.
Unfortunately.
Boris Godunov is an absolute masterpiece, but virtually unknown outside Russia, and probably actually not staged very often in Russia itself. It's a play that's better known in its operatic version, Mussorgsky's great opera, which is based on Pushkin's play, but really gives the wrong impression of the original text, doesn't it?
Yes, it's very, very different. It's Pushkin described his play as a comedy, and Mussorgsky opera is like a Verdi Shakespeare tragedy.
Utter tragedy.
And it could not, it's chalk and cheese. Yeah. They're almost opposite in tone, intent, purpose. It's quite extraordinary, actually, the difference. And I know which one I prefer.
Well, it's difficult to stage, isn't it? It's a play that's written not written in acts, it's written in scenes, sometimes very short. There's a cinema quality about it when you actually read it.
Call it a cinema if you want. I call it Shakespearean,
right,
where Shakespeare effortlessly dives about from different parts of the country or the world with Out So Much As A By Your Leave. And Pushkin is very consciously learning from the English master in that way, dramaturgically. He knew that he was following Shakespeare consciously, partly to escape what he saw as the strictures of French neoclassicism, the French neoclassicism of Racine and Corneille, partly because I think he was very conscious of, for instance, Shakespeare's ability to write about England under Elizabeth I, but not get into jail or trouble with the authorities, because he could plead innocence and deniability by saying, "Oh, it's all about the past. I'm just a foolish player. You know, I'm just a mechanical that you don't need to worry about," just as Pushkin is sort of saying, "I'm just a foolish skamarok."
Well, Pushkin had a very, very complicated relationship with the authorities, didn't he?
Yeah,
and he was
absolutely
a society figure. The difference between Nicholas I's Russia and Elizabeth I's England, well, you probably say they're similar.
They have things in common. Elizabeth took a very close interest in the goings-on of the cultural scene in London, and particularly the playhouses. Actually, she was possibly in person a slightly more liberating force than Nicholas was, although Nicholas tried, I think probably in good faith, to help Pushkin out in his struggles with the censor. But in the end, Nicholas ended up being his personal censor, and poor Pushkin never saw this play. One of the reasons I think it hasn't been done more often is it was never done in his lifetime and was suppressed at various different times, because it doesn't paint an enormously flattering picture of power, authority, or government.
As you say, it humorises it, which is not what power likes. Does it have, are there any precedents, are there any productions that you've got in mind? Have you ever seen it in English? Or
no, I've never seen it full stop. Oh. I'm aware, one of my, a very good friend of mine and one of my favourite directors is Declan Donnellan, who I just know, will have done, and I have heard from people, did a beautiful production in Russian with the Chekhov Festival of Boris Godunov, which I think started in the early 2000s and then was revived mid-2000s and has toured around the world, including to here. I'm very grateful that I haven't seen that production, because I can...
You can approach
it. I think, it might have been too good. I'm free to make my own mistakes.
That opens on November the 15th, isn't it, at Stratford?
Yes, I think it starts playing from the 15th and the press night is on the 28th.
Right, OK. So that's great news. That is actually your last production as artistic director at the Royal Shakespeare Company, is that right?
It's my first production as a freelance director at the RSC, actually.
Right.
I'm no longer artistic
life.
Director. I've already handed over the red briefcase to Gregory Doran, who's taken over as artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I'm now footloose and fancy-free and an irresponsible artist on the loose. Yes.
Well, you won't be for very long, unfortunately. Do you have any plans? Are you going to continue with Russian theatre somewhere? Are you ever going to work in Russia itself?
I am working on potentially two Chekhov-related projects. I'm planning a production of The Cherry Orchard over the next few years, and possibly doing some work on Chekhov's Sakhalin Diaries, maybe alongside that. I'm sure there will be other Russian projects that I would love to pursue. Pushkin, I didn't know Pushkin that well before I started work on Boris. I always thought of him as the sort of more sophisticated and handsome elder brother of Gogol, who I knew very well.
Of course.
And it's been lovely getting to know the humanity and the vulnerability and the playfulness and the mischief of Pushkin himself.
So Little Tragedies are going to...
Well, yes, I think they're really interesting.
Oh, they're marvellous, aren't they?
Yes.
The economy and the life in them is just extraordinary.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely stage life in them.
What about the Chekhov short stories? That's a project that you brought about at the ROC, a staged version of the short stories.
We commissioned one or two people to look at that and we staged some readings. None of them have yet come to full production. I collaborated with the Pushkin Theatre in 1989 at a festival of Soviet theatre called Novye Nachinanie in Glasgow. And the Pushkin Theatre brought over Chekhov's story Ward 6 in a beautiful production that played the tramway in Glasgow as part of the festival that I was directing. But I'm a huge fan of Chekhov's short stories, and the idea of dramatizing one of those is very appealing to me myself. I haven't yet got involved in that project.
So that is definitely something which we can
absolutely
look out for, right? Yeah. Michael, the other great legacy you're leaving the ROC is that you are really promoting women as directors and women in theatre. I don't know how that's thought of in Russia. Of course, women work in theatre in Russia. Probably the same arguments are there, that they're not included enough. But that's something definitely, it's a big thing for you, isn't it?
It's not necessarily been a conscious campaign on my part. Certainly, I can't remember banging the table about it as much as I've banged the table about ethnic diversity, for instance, at the RSC. I think I've just been struck by the number of talented actors and designers, fantastic designers, and a whole generation of directors are now emerging. Very important that, nothing to do with the RSC, that Vicky Featherston, now the first national company in Britain, has been taken over by a woman with Vicky Featherston moving from the National Theatre of Scotland to the Royal Court. That's tremendous. And I'm very pleased that in next year's season at the RSC, we've got six women directors really dominating the year. And a complete, interesting, sort of quite cross-generational, from brilliant babies like Maria Arberg from Sweden to people who have been on the scene for a while, like Nancy Meckler, and who has done a number of landmark productions for the RSC, and mavericks like Emma Rice, who I've had to corral into actually doing a play, because she normally devises, and I've got her into bed with the Anglo-Indian writer Tanika Gupta, and Emma's working on a proper script, which is brilliant.
So really what you're saying is you're not really interested in promoting women for theatre generically, you're interested in promoting talent generally.
Yes, I mean, it's a fine line, isn't it, between positive action, affirmative action, and just recognising the talent that's there. And I'm not hugely aware of exercising a great deal of bias in favour of women. But I have had my eyes and ears open.
That was Julian Gallant talking to Michael Boyd of the Royal Shakespeare Company. You've been listening to Curtain Up with me, Alice Lagnado, on The Voice of Russia in London.